Our Old Testament lesson today is from 1 Samuel, chapter 8, verses 6 through 22, as translated in The Message. Listen now for God's word. When Samuel heard their demand, "Give us a king to rule us," he was crushed. How awful. Samuel prayed to God. God answered Samuel, "Go ahead and do what they're asking. They are not rejecting you. They've rejected me as their king. From the day I brought them out of Egypt until this very day, they've been behaving like this, leaving me for other gods. And now they're doing it to you. So let them have their own way, but warn them of what they're in for. Tell them the way kings operate, just what they're likely to get from a king." So Samuel told them, delivered God's warning to the people who were asking him to give them a king. He said, "This is the way the kind of king you're talking about operates. He'll take your sons and make soldiers of them, chariotry, cavalry, infantry, regimented in battalions and squadrons. He'll put some to forced labor on his farms, plowing and harvesting, and others to making either weapons of war or chariots in which he can ride in luxury. He'll put your daughters to work as beauticians and waitresses and cooks. He'll conscript your best fields, vineyards, and orchards and hand them over to his special friends. He'll tax your harvests and vintage to support his extensive bureaucracy. Your prize workers and best animals he'll take for his own use. He'll lay a tax on your flocks, and you'll end up no better than slaves. The day will come when you will cry in desperation because of this king you so much want for yourselves. But don't expect God to answer." But the people wouldn't listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we will have a king to rule us. Then we'll be just like all the other nations. Our king will rule us and lead us and fight our battles." Samuel took in what they said and rehearsed it with God. God told Samuel, "Do what they say, make them a king." Then Samuel dismissed the men of Israel, "Go home, each of you to your own city." The New Testament lesson is from Matthew, chapter 5, verses 1 through 12, part of the Sermon on the Mount, as translated in the New Revised Standard Version. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor."
Well, good morning. It's great to be with you this morning. You know, this is Veterans Day, a day when we honor those who have served our country. And it was 100 years ago today, at just about this hour, at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, the guns of World War I finally fell silent. That war lasted more than 4 years and cost almost 20 million people their lives. History has much to teach us about the horrors of war, and trench warfare in particular, but also about missed opportunities for peace. One of the little-known events of that war occurred almost 4 years earlier, soon after the outbreak of the war. It's known as the Christmas Truce. In 1914, as Christmas approached, the military commanders on both sides had dismissed any possibility of a truce. But the soldiers took matters into their own hands. It seems to have begun on the German side as they began to sing Silent Night and other carols. The British and French responded with their own Christmas carols. And soon, soldiers were tentatively poking their heads out of the trenches and then coming out and meeting one another in no man's land. There are reports of exchanging gifts of rations, of pipe tobacco, of buttons, rum, and even helping one another to bury their dead. And yes, they even played soccer. To be sure, this truce was unofficial, and it didn't happen everywhere along the front line, but it happened in enough places that it became a problem to return to the business of killing. One account describes a German officer, after the truce, pacing up and down his line of soldiers, ordering them to commence firing. And one of the soldiers replied, "We can't, sir. They're good fellows. We can't." And the officer replied, "You commence firing or I will, and it won't be at the enemy." That soldier says, "So we commenced firing, wasting ammunition all that day and the next, trying to shoot the stars down from the sky." Ultimately, thousands of soldiers on both sides had to be replaced because they had lost their will to kill. One of the soldiers said, "If it had been up to us, we never would have fired another shot." Please pray with me. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts lead us more deeply into love of our neighbor and justice for all creation, O God. Amen. You know, there's so much that can be said on the subject of being a peace church that I feel a little bit like Mark Twain, who, in writing a letter to a friend of his, apologized for writing such a long letter because he said, "I didn't have time to write a short one." Almost 2 years ago, the session of this church voted unanimously to declare ourselves a peace church. You'll notice that a copy of this resolution is in your bulletin. But like any good preacher, I encourage you to read it after the prompting. We were the first church in our denomination to declare ourselves a peace church. Since then, another church in North Carolina and Montclair Presbyterian Church in Oakland, where Ben Daniel is the preacher, has also declared themselves a peace church. Then last summer, in an overture passed by this church and our presbytery, we asked the General Assembly to recognize and commend churches who declare themselves peace churches. That overture passed overwhelmingly in General Assembly. In working with the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship, we're currently working on curriculum to help other churches discern whether they want to declare themselves peace churches. Now, many of you helped to make that resolution possible by sharing your thoughts and your opinions, oh, a lot of opinions, with the Social Justice Committee. It started several years ago now when we held several adult study sessions and we asked the very simple question, what do you think about the use of violence and war? Those conversations turned out to be extraordinary. For one thing, we discovered that our experiences and opinions on the subject are as diverse as any other congregation. We're made up of veterans and conscientious objectors and everything in between. Now, we learned that with compassionate and heartfelt listening, there is much to be learned from one another on this subject. We also learned that you wanted to keep the conversation going because we found that these were some of the best conversations we had had in our church for a long time. But the question that kept being asked that was really important, it was a wonderful question, it was an important question, was why should we declare ourselves a peace church? After all, aren't we already a peace church? This church is known for preaching peace and justice from the pulpit and in our actions in the community. So aren't we already a peace church? And I remember back in 2003, marching through the streets of San Francisco with a lot of you, and we had the banner for this church that we were carrying with us. And we found other Presbyterians up there who said, "Oh, I'm so glad I found you." And so the consensus reply or response to that question was, yes, it is important for us to declare ourselves a peace church because it's important that we make what is implicit explicit. There's value in going through the exercise to articulate what being a peace church means to us in this time, in this place. This is the value of our Reformed tradition, after all. It is the value of being Reformed and reforming. The work of being reformed into the image of Christ is never done. Robert McAfee Brown once said that the work of theology is a love letter to God. And it's also a conversation, an ongoing conversation with the Bible, our faith tradition, and the world around us. In fact, the Bible can be understood as a conversation with God. Sure, the Bible's full of praise and hallelujahs, but it's also full of gut-wrenching anger and pain and crying out to God in the middle of defeat and exile. A 2,000-year-long history of the church is a continuation of that conversation. It's a tumultuous one, to be sure. The Barman Declaration in 1934 is now one of our confessions, was written in the midst of Nazi Germany's attempt to take over the German Christian church. Hitler was working to seize control of the churches by making them subordinate to the state to promote Nazi propaganda and ideology. But the Barman Declaration was a marker in history, declaring that the church has only one ruler, and that is Jesus Christ, and that they reject the church's subordination to the state. Now, when this church spoke out prophetically, declaring this church to be a more light church, you were putting a marker down in the history of the church, saying this is what we believe the love of God looks like. A place where LGBT folks are not just tolerated, but are loved, honored, and welcomed. Many other churches chose not to do that, but only offered passive support. But you believe that God's love is not passive, but active. When our General Assembly passes overtures on immigration or supporting Dreamers or addressing gun violence or calling for peace in Sudan, we are saying, in effect, this is where we stand. This is who we believe God is calling us to be. When the session passed this resolution declaring us a peace church, you are saying, this is where we stand. Now, it may seem naive or quaint for those of us in this calm and privileged oasis of Palo Alto to attempt to speak out against violence and militarism and in support of nonviolence and reconciliation. But we have all seen on the news these last few weeks how gun violence is rampant. Our hearts break for the families of two black citizens shot outside a Kroger grocery store, for the 11 members of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and now for the 12 people killed in the shooting in Thousand Oaks. I was astounded to learn that there have been at least 307 mass shootings in our country this year alone. That's almost one every day. You know, to be honest, it's hard to keep track. And we risk becoming numb and allowing these actions to become normalized. But if we've learned anything through the years, we've learned how we are all our concerns are interconnected, how they intersect. Dr. King reminds us, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Now, speaking personally, I have come to realize that war and militarism are at the heart of so many downstream problems we see around the world, whether it's domestic and sexual violence against women, child abuse, white supremacy and domination, unjust incarceration policies, poverty, maintaining corporate profitability at the expense of the needs of the people, even the government's blindness to climate change and irreparable harm to this beloved planet. We must connect the dots between war and militarism and the highest gun rate of violence in the developed world. We must connect the dots between our homeless and hungry and hurting people and the homeless and starving people of Yemen. Reverend William Barber and Reverend Liz Theo Harris, who's a Presbyterian minister, I might add, of the Poor People's Campaign, they point out that there are 140 million people in our country who are poor or low income. That includes one-third of all whites, about 60% of blacks, 65% of the Hispanics, and more than 50% of all children. Student debt has risen to more than $1.3 trillion. Now, why is this important? It's important because while the government keeps cutting funds for anti-poverty programs like SNAP or food stamps, they keep increasing the funds for the military. 53 cents out of every dollar spent in the U.S. discretionary budget is spent on the military. Now, exact numbers are hard to come by, but some economists say that we have spent $5.6 trillion on war since 2001. Imagine that. Imagine what $5.6 trillion could have done for our own citizens, for those who are hungry and homeless, for universal health care, for tuition for our young people, for our infrastructure. I'm pretty sure that President Dwight Eisenhower was a reader of the Bible and 1 Samuel chapter 8 in particular. He warned us about the military-industrial complex taking over our economy. You be the judge and let me know if you agree. In a speech to newspaper editors in 1953, he said, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 people. It is two finely equipped hospitals." And then he closes saying this: "This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron." We have been at war in the Middle East for more than 17 years, and yet the number of terrorist groups has only increased. We have troops stationed in 177 countries around the world. And yet, the world is becoming ever more violent. As the saying goes, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I'll leave you with one more quote from Dr. King. I'm sure you've heard it before, but it bears repeating. The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that. I have to admit, my friends, that I fear for our country. This is a dark time, and it may get darker still. But this resolution that you passed is a light. Let's not put it under a bushel. The world needs courageous communities now more than ever. The world needs communities that are willing to take risks for justice and peace. Read that resolution. This is not the end of the conversation, but let it be the beginning. Thanks be to God.